Hey guys, this is Beth Golay. And before we get started with Marginalia, I just wanted to say that KMUW's podcast platform is made possible by High Touch Technologies, a software technology and business communications company that provides products, services, and support to all industries. High Touch brings the human touch to technology with a world-class team of industry experts. Learn more at hightouchtechnologies.com. And now, here's Marginalia.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia, notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Author Ruta Sepetys is often referred to as the seeker of lost stories. She has written four works of historical fiction published in over 60 countries and in 40 languages. Her latest, The Fountains of Silence, is set in 1957 Madrid and explores Spain living under the dictatorship of General Francisco Franco. Sepetys is considered a crossover novelist because her books are read both by students and adults worldwide. I caught up with her recently to visit about the new book and about writing for young adults. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation.
The Fountains of Silence is set in 1957 in Madrid, and it follows the story of 18-year-old Daniel Matheson, who's the son of a Texas oil baron, who is visiting Madrid with his parents. And Spain is under the dictatorship of Francisco Franco at this time in 1957. Well, at the hotel, Daniel meets Anna, a Spanish girl who's working as a maid at the hotel. And together, Daniel and Anna embark upon a journey that unknowingly puts both of their lives in danger.
So when did you first catch wind of this story? I'm just diving right in here about there were babies being stolen from people who were on the wrong side of Franco. Parents were told that their babies had died and they were being adopted out to other people who would raise them without the tainted red blood in them. When did you first catch wind of the story?
I first caught wind of the story in 2011 after my first book tour in Spain. The readers in Spain, they were so compassionate about the hidden history in my novels and those who experienced it. And I wanted to know more about their history. And so I began researching, and my publisher at the time sent me an article that estimated that hundreds of thousands of children were stolen from families that didn't align with the Franco regime, and they were gifted and sold to fascist families. And this was one of the elements of the dictatorship that I was researching. You know, during the dictatorship, there was no freedom of speech. There was no freedom of the press, no freedom of religion. There were no equal rights. A woman was not allowed to open a bank account or apply for a passport without special permission. And so it was a very oppressive environment. And it was in my research that I did discover these alleged thefts of children.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the characters, because your chapters are told from a chorus of characters. We learn the story through this family that is very fearful of the regime. We learn the story through Americans who are living in Madrid, either as like the son of an ambassador or the son of this oil man from Texas who is also staying at the hotel. We learn about the story through journalism, through Ben, who is a journalist working in Madrid. We learn the story through photography, because Daniel and Ben are both interested in journalism and telling the story through photos. We learn the story through a young girl who's working at one of these orphanages. Talk to me a little bit about the research that went into all of those different points of view and all of those different perspectives.
That's a great question, because it was actually the research that birthed all those points of view and perspectives. I spent 7 years researching the novel because I am not Spanish. I knew I would have to spend a much longer amount of time doing the research. And what I want to do when I'm presenting a piece of history is to try to present a balanced portrayal. So I interview countless people who were on opposite sides of the history. And as I'm interviewing those people, there are certain narratives, certain emotions that jump out to me. And that's when I start pulling threads from different interviews and weaving together, let's say, 20 different people into one composite character.
So you also mentioned, I saw in your author notes that, you know, in your first three books, you wrote from the inside out, and now this story is written from the outside in. Talk to me about the differences, you know, how those differences affected your storytelling.
Yes, my three prior books all had threads of my personal family history. So I was able to write those books, as I say, from the inside out. But because I'm not Spanish and I don't speak Spanish, I had to write this book from the outside in. And so as I started researching, I began to look, you know, what is my in? What's the outside in? And although during the dictatorship, most of the neighboring European countries, they would have nothing to do with Franco. They didn't want to have anything to do with the dictatorship. The train tracks in Spain were purposely a different width to control the flow of entries and exits into the country. But there was one country that was doing business with Franco, and that was the United States. Franco needed money for Spain, and he allowed the United States to put a couple military bases there. He opened Spain to the Texas oil families to drill. The Hollywood movie studios were shooting films there. So I picked up on this oil thread and created this character of Daniel Matheson, who comes from an oil family, who arrives in Madrid. And that's how I was going to write it, with the viewpoint from the outside in.
There were a couple of phrases I jotted down while reading the book, and I'd like for you to comment on them, if you would. One is, without fear, we will never meet courage. What inspired that quote?
Oh, thank you for pulling that out. I think that's the truth. If we're never fearful, perhaps we won't have an opportunity to step up, step outside of ourselves, push ourselves, do something that's uncomfortable. And so fear, in that way, although it's uncomfortable at the time, it helps us grow. And that's what I meant. You know, if we never meet fear, we'll never have courage.
Another one is, there is a tension that exists between history and memory. And that was in the text, and you also referenced something very similar to that in your author's note. Talk to me about that.
I absolutely find that with the books that I've written, that there is this fragile tension between history and memory. Some people are desperate to remember, but others are desperate to forget. And I think we can all relate to that. Maybe some of your listeners have, you know, grandparents who are desperate to forget a situation, or now, I know myself, I'm desperate to remember. The older I get, I'm desperate to remember. But that creates this sort of elasticity when some people are searching for the information and some people don't want the information to be found.
And then finally, there's one more from the author's note. What right do we have to history other than our own?
That was a statement that I just was bouncing through my mind as I was writing this book, because I'm an outsider. And writing the book, this is very specific history. I did not experience the history that I'm writing about. And that's, again, why I chose to tell the story through an American and also a photographer. So we see the history and the story unfolding through his lens. And so it's not as if he's owning the history, he's experiencing the history. And sometimes, as tourists, this main character is a tourist, you know, sometimes you've heard the term unreliable narrator. Sometimes as tourists, I think we're unreliable observers. We arrive somewhere and there's a narrative that's immediately thrust at us. For example, I live in Nashville. When you exit at the airport, you know, it says Music City, USA. Well, there's a lot more to Nashville, you know, than just music. But these narratives are thrust at us. And I wondered, as I was creating the character of Daniel Matheson and as he was exploring Madrid, what sort of messaging would he see? What sort of conclusions would he be coming to? And then also, what would he see and what would unfold through the lens of his camera?
You included epigraphs at the beginning of each chapter and historical photos as well. And honestly, it made me search for the word novel on the jacket just to make sure I knew what I was reading, because I started the book and I saw the quotes and I saw the images, and nowhere on the front of the jacket does it say novel, and I finally found it on the inside flap. How important is it to this piece of historical fiction to include non-fictional elements to you?
For me, that was a decision that was made actually as I was writing and researching. As I said, I spent 7 years researching this novel. And when I was going into the diplomatic archives, the presidential archives, since the United States was doing business with Spain, there was a lot of information on record. There were a lot of press reports and news reports. And what I found in those oral history archives was so fascinating to me, and for me, so completely unknown, that I thought, wow, wouldn't it be fascinating if I put these in the book? So as readers are reading, and they're reading and flowing through the story, then they see these real statements that can give context and reference to the story.
You are considered a crossover author, which means that although your books are published for teens, adults read them in great numbers. Is there a difference in writing for teens versus writing for adults? Because the writing didn't seem less than anything for me. Do chapter lengths differ? How is it different for you?
No, actually, it doesn't differ at all. And I say that because young readers are deep thinkers and deep feelers. They have such a sense of emotional truth, and so they bring a lot of honesty as they read a book. And that's important to me. The last people you ever want to speak down to or write down to are young adults. You know, they'll call you out right away. What I do, because I know I have a young adult audience, is I challenge myself to describe things like brutality or aggression in a way that isn't gratuitous. And so that's really the only distinction that I make, would be probably profanity and some sort of, like, you know, gratuitous violence. I try to create phrases in a way that might express the same thing without just being so blatant and putting it on the page.
What is your hope that young readers will take away from this book?
I hope that young readers take away a couple of things. First, that when history remains hidden in the shadows, the people who experience the history, sometimes they believe the world has forgotten them or they're not important. And that's not the case at all. We just don't know their story. And I want young readers to know that by reading these pieces of history, that truly they're restoring the human dignity of someone who suffered in a very difficult way. But I also want young people to realize that through these situations of hardship and adversity, there's also a lot of hope and joy to be found. When I'm researching these difficult periods that included, you know, war and suffering, I also find that amidst all of this hardship, people were falling desperately in love. And that's so encouraging to me, that there is, like, meaning in hardship and that you can find strength through struggle.
You included a reference at the very end of the book. You included a reference to an NPR story which aired in August of 2018, that the first of these stolen babies cases went to court in Spain. Where do things stand now?
Well, right now, they've absolutely made progress. And each case that comes up and that is examined, they're discovering new information. Some people who were certain that they were stolen, it's been realized recently that they weren't. But what's important is that these various cases are being heard, and I think that's progress. Will we ever know the actual figure, the actual number of children that were potentially stolen? I don't know, but I think progress is possible.
That was Ruta Sepetys, author of the book The Fountains of Silence, which was published by Philomel. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.